It's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, discussion on presidential power, recorded last night at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch before a live audience. Our panelists, NPR's Sarah McCammon, presidential historian Tim Walch, and UNI political scientist Donna Hoffman. Now to some of that conversation from last night.
So let's start off with this president and put it in the context of the office of the presidency and other presidents who've come before Donald Trump. Let me start out with our historian. How has President Trump been within the tradition of the American presidency, Tim Walch? How has he been outside of it? Is he in what ways acting like presidents in the past, and in what ways is he sort of dancing outside the lines?
Well, it's a good question, Ben, and let's talk about this week because Saturday marks the 100th day of his presidency, and it's an arbitrary point at which to evaluate him, which extends back to, frankly, Franklin D. Roosevelt, as most folks know, the 100 days of the New Deal. And every president since Roosevelt has suffered under the burden of 100 days. It's early in a presidency. How can you accomplish very much? But President Trump is very competitive. And on the one hand, he'll say, well, it's an arbitrary, meaningless measure. On the other hand, he wants to be the most successful president in the first 100 days. So it's a sort of a study in contradictions. And folks read the New York Times this morning. Peter Baker has a wonderful column which really dissects and articulates this. And to his credit, he has signed 25 executive orders, and he has signed 28 bills during that 100 days, and that's a substantial achievement. Now, many of the executive orders are kind of low-hanging fruit and easy to do. Many of the laws that he has signed are changing the name of a VA facility. The challenge he faces, as do all new presidents, is the difficult legislation, the one that requires the cooperation of Congress he has yet to achieve. And he feels that burden. He wants to be seen as the most successful president, and he's not shy about telling people that, which makes him a little different. Most presidents want to be humble like Abraham Lincoln. But Donald Trump is not imbued with that kind of personal humility. And he has tapped into a social media stream through Twitter, although he's using Twitter less these days, that is given to it's kind of unbridled expectations.
Sarah McCammon, you covered the Trump campaign for many months, were on many planes, on many buses, following the campaign around, a campaign that even the admirers of Donald Trump and not to mention the political pundits never expected this campaign to be successful in reaching the White House. It was. How did you in your press pool interpret the way this candidate and then president communicated so differently?
I think, you know, I began by covering a range of Republican candidates, you know, including here in Iowa. And I think at the time, early on, you know, there was the predictions that we heard from so many pundits and experts and pollsters were eventually, you know, this is going to collapse. This is like a bubble that's going to burst and the American Republican electorate will sort of simmer down and pick somebody a little more suitable, a little more traditional. And of course, that didn't happen. And arguably, you know, that was a failure of the media and of pollsters to recognize that really, I mean, if Trump, if you looked at his poll numbers and his success in early primaries and his, you know, crowd sizes and all these other markers, and he had any other name, most likely he would have been seen as a sort of likely front runner, but no one could really believe that someone with this sort of style and these positions would make it to where he is.
Do we think of the president's tweets any differently than we would think of something he said himself in a press conference or in a press release? I've had it suggested to me early on, perhaps you did too, Sarah, that the tweets of the candidate and then the president should be seen in a different light. Do you think that are they there as a distraction? Are they the real deal? Tim Walch, how do you see that? Radio at one time was new.
Well, absolutely. Imagine what it would be like, for example, if Abraham Lincoln had a Twitter account or Theodore Roosevelt. It's a technological tool in each person's set of qualities and perhaps limitations will determine how they use that tool. To President Trump's credit, he recognized that this was a powerful medium that the other candidates did not tap into, and it was as if he had access to a limited access highway and was able to drive his car just as fast as he could to get to the audience he wanted to reach. The others were all crowded in other forms of communication. So I do give him great credit, but 140 characters will limit you, and if you're not subtle and sophisticated in how you use Twitter, it can come back to haunt you, as it has on several occasions for President Trump. My question to the audience, too, is do you think all of these tweets should be considered public records? And should the National Archives be saving all of the Twitter feeds that the president is generating?
Well, let's get a radio-friendly clapping poll on this. How many believe that it, clap if you believe that it should be part of the National Archives. Thinking we've got a majority.
Play into a friendly crowd, man.
Got a majority there. Well, I mean, it is the presidential record. We have a question or a comment from the audience. Yes, sir. Tell us who you are.
My name is Charles Cranston, Iowa City, and so my question is that it seems like the fireside chat, the Saturday or Sunday morning radio address, and the tweets themselves were all ways to circumvent the media pool and get the message directly to the general public without having to ever face questions from the media or anything that would be challenging or directly confrontational. And I'm wondering if there's been other examples of that in history.
I would just, I mean, others can probably speak more to the history of presidential communication, but I would just point out that this was a sort of a hot issue for both major party nominees during the 2016 campaign, was this question of accessibility and transparency with the press. Hillary Clinton also got a lot of flack from the press for being resistant to you know, sit down interviews, being resistant to uncontrolled media environments, and I remember at one point, sort of over the summer in 2016, you know, it was sort of a back and forth between the two over who was, you know, less accessible. Trump's campaign was sending out daily press releases, I believe, counting up the number of days since Hillary Clinton had a press conference. And then he basically gave a press conference in July and then didn't do any more press conferences until the end of the campaign. So, you know, this was, and Trump, of course, used Twitter in a very different way than the Clinton campaign. But to your point about circumventing the mainstream media, I think candidates are getting increasingly sophisticated in some cases and realizing that sometimes, you know, pragmatically for them, whether or not it's good for democracy, it's better for them just not to take very many questions from reporters.
Ben, I'd just like to add to this, too, is that we tend to forget that in the 19th century, newspapers were biased in favor of one candidate or the other, and often candidates would pitch to their particular newspaper. And so it's not a surprise, for example, if you go to many small communities, even here in Iowa, that they might have a newspaper with the name the Manchester Democrat. Well, that was a Democratic newspaper, or the Manchester Republican was a Republican newspaper. So just like we have cable channels that seem to pitch to one particular point of view, in the 19th century you had newspapers that pitched to that point of view. And as Charles suggested in his question, every single candidate would like to have control of the news feed and the narrative, and so they tend to pitch the best stories to the paper that they think is going to be most sympathetic. But the best of all possible worlds in their mind is to be able to speak directly to the American people, you know, using the bully pulpit, so to speak, the big megaphone that allows them to speak to the whole audience.
If you just joined us, it's a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This is a conversation recorded at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, and an audience of about a couple hundred here in the auditorium. On the stage, we've been listening to Sarah McCammon, now NPR reporter, formerly of Iowa Public Radio, Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa, and presidential historian Tim Walch. And we're trying to include a lot of feedback, questions, observations, experiences in how we as Iowans reflect on presidential power. And let's go to another question or observation from our audience. Yes, step up and tell us who you are, please.
Well, my name is Althea Cole. I'm a political activist from Cedar Rapids, and I was one of the lead volunteers in the Cedar Rapids Republican Victory Office for the 2016 campaign. I may be one of the only people under 40 who absolutely despises Twitter. I hate it because nothing that I have to say other than a pithy remark here and there is going to fit into 140 characters. So I found it very interesting when we had said, the only people who actually see Donald Trump tweets are those who sign up for Twitter, because I've sent 2 tweets in the last year. I think that's how often I've checked Twitter as well. And yet I see on the news practically, maybe not every day, but at least a couple times a week, some kind of coverage about a tweet that Donald Trump sent out. So to say that we only receive them, if we are on Twitter, I think that's a little incorrect, because I think the media, whether it could be that he intends for this to happen. Donald Trump sends out a tweet and the media picks it up and runs with it. And all of a sudden, you've got every political pundit on the face of the earth sitting down at the desk and talking about this for 5-minute segments.
The way I interpret you saying that is that you're saying we shouldn't be doing that in the media, if I can speak about that in the collective. Why not? These are the president's words. Are they any less valid than if he had spoken them?
I'm definitely not saying that they should not be discussed in the media. But if they are seen as a way to sidestep the media, clearly that's not working very well, because oftentimes a presidential tweet from Donald Trump can oftentimes be the first thing that leads off the story during the newscast.
When I said sidestep the media, I'm referring more to getting the message that he or any other user of Twitter wants to get directly to the people, to the base, rather than having to go through this conduit of sitting down with a journalist and answering questions. It's a very different dynamic, because when you tweet, you get to decide what is said and what is not said, whereas when you sit down with a journalist or in a room full of reporters and take questions, you're subject to a much greater level of scrutiny.
So let's go to a member of our audience. Yes, sir, tell us who you are.
I'm David Johnson. I'm from West Branch.
And we spoke earlier. I want to comment here. You're also a veteran of the first Gulf War. Thank you, David, for your service to our country.
My pleasure. What I find interesting is not so much the method by which Donald Trump speaks to us, be it tweeting. What I find interesting is that Donald Trump can say things that would absolutely sink any other political candidate. And the reason he can do that is because he started that method early on in the primary season when he wasn't supposed to win. And nobody took him seriously. And in fact, the media thought he was funny. So for him, this is a learned experience, right? I can say whatever the heck I want, and look what happened. I won, right? So for us to expect him to quickly change his method of articulating his thoughts is, I think, unrealistic, because it's a learned experience for him. And I think it is true that now that he's out of that campaign mode, he needs to now be in the governing mode. And that type of rhetoric is not going to work when you're trying to build coalitions. So I think it's going to be a rocky 4 years.
Another audience member, yes, sir, your name.
Sure, Armand Dawson from Cedar Rapids. I want to piggyback off of some of what this gentleman just said. It kind of sparked something with me. Because President Trump has been so effective at using this medium, or using this one-sided approach to leading the country at this point, will other politicians, you think, down the road take that same approach? Will they exhibit the same behaviors? Will they use the medium in the ways that he's used these mediums to, try to control his message and get others to kind of fall in line with it? Will others kind of march to the beat of that drum? And if so, will that change the landscape of politics for us going forward? Will it change the landscape from a leadership perspective for us going forward? And is that a good place for us to be as a country leading the free world?
Thoughts on that question?
I would add that Trump is unique. And so while I do think there is potential, Twitter's not going to go away, and we'll have something new probably in the next cycle. I don't think, as David was mentioning, Trump can get away with a lot of things that other politicians can't. And so I think there are going to be a lot of ways in which he's going to be an anomaly. Having said that, though, I do think he will expand the way that candidates do behave. One of the things we might think about, you know, this being an audience of Iowans, is that Trump campaigned in the lead up to the caucuses in a very unusual manner. And he did not go out and to Pizza Ranch. I don't think he ever appeared at Pizza Ranch. He very rarely shook hands with people to, you know, get to look Iowans in the eye, as we always say, answer their questions. He had big events. He flew in, he flew out. He didn't spend a lot of time here. And he came in second in the caucuses. So he didn't win, but he came in second. It's respectable. But in the next caucuses, the people who advise presidential hopefuls are not going to say to those people, oh, we'll do the Donald Trump method, because it won't work in Iowa for anybody but Donald Trump. Maybe Oprah Winfrey if she decides to run. But he had such a persona of being a straight talker, being a celebrity, being a television personality, that he could do that in Iowa, and it was relatively successful for him. Ted Cruz, who did win the Iowa caucuses, did the hard pavement work of organizing in the state like every other successful Republican or Democrat has typically done in the state. Trump did respectable, but Trump is Trump. He is unusual. So again, to your you know, comment, yeah, I do think that we will see some changes that Trump will bring us. But I do think at the end of the day, we're still going to see him in some ways as an anomaly, because there are things that he's saying that would sink any other presidential candidate. And I don't think other presidential hopefuls are going to be able to skate by on those kinds of things like Trump did or has so far.
Perhaps implicit in that question would be, too, will we ever see a candidate downed by a comment he or she makes, a 47% type comment, or a binders full of women comment? I mean, when we think back on those now, do they seem, how high are they even on the harmless scale now compared to what we've experienced in this last thing? Can we have made a quantum leap in something. What?
We have, but I think, you know, 2016 isn't a perfect test case for this, and I that's a big question I have as a journalist in the future, is what, you know, what will future politicians be able to sort of get away with? But I think we saw, you know, Ben Carson was sort of having a surge, and then there was some reporting on, you know, whether or not he'd really stabbed someone with a scissors or something as a child. I mean, and like these relatively sort of smaller things that would have taken down other candidates in the past did seem to affect some of the other candidates. I think part of the reason perhaps that Trump was able to get away with saying things that other candidates couldn't say is because a lot of the people, at least that I talked to, really had an appetite for something new and different. And I think they saw Trump's, I think the fact that he wasn't a politician gave him a little bit more leeway to say things. And as one of our audience members mentioned earlier, the fact that he sort of set that tone from the very beginning and it didn't seem to hurt him, you know, and a lot of his supporters found that simplicity and even the brusqueness of his message really refreshing and really, again, indicative of the idea that he wasn't a standard politician. And to people who were tired of the political system, that trait seemed to point in the direction of something new and something different that they were looking for.
I want to reach out to Trump supporters in this audience and find out, what are your views on how you feel this president is wielding power in his first 100 days? Are you happy with it? To spin off of what we were just talking about, is this what you expected when you backed Donald Trump? In the first, yes, sir. You raised your hand or yes. Indicated you're a Donald Trump supporter.
I voted for Donald Trump, and I look at it like this. You know, the presidency is a 4-year term, and I'll be honest with you, if I was judged on the first 100 days of my job, I'd probably get fired. Okay, so I think that what Donald Trump does, mainly because he's not a politician, everybody in the country knows that, and he's still in a learning process. That's the way I look at it. So would I vote for him again? Probably. I would probably expect more, though.
I forgot to ask your name.
Bobby Wade. I live in Oxford, Iowa.
Okay. So when you say you backed him with your vote, and we look, admittedly, short time in the 4-year presidency, 100 days, you're not surprised. You're seeing that he's keeping true to his what you expected when you elected him, helped elect him.
Well, I wouldn't say he's necessarily keeping true to it, but I would agree with what Donna said. You know that he's one person in a Congress of, you know, hundreds of people, and not one person has the power or the authority to make any major changes like that. So they all have to come together as a team to make the changes that we need.
Other observations, questions from the audience? Let's go way over to the end. Sir, please identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Don Rochter from Iowa City. Article 1, the Congress, they were supposed to make policy for our country. That's what the Founding Fathers intended. And yet we find that both the court and the president are much more looked to as policymakers today, and it's mostly because Congress has abdicated their role. They've found that being a congressman is a very cushy proposition, and so they try to get reelected. And the way to do that is to bring home the bacon and take care of people's problems as an ombudsman rather than to stand up on policy issues. Because when you stand up on policy issues, you make half the people happy, but you make half the people upset. Nobody gets upset if you help Aunt Sadie get her Social Security squared away. Nobody gets upset if you bring home a new bridge to the district. And so it's the problem that we have too much presidential power, too much court power, because Congress doesn't want to exercise the power they're supposed to do.
Yeah, and Congress has been complicit in giving that power. They passed the Budget and Accounting Act in 1921 and said, here, President, have a little bit of our power of the purse. They make the president give an economic report in the mid part of the 20th century. They knew we don't declare war anymore. The founders were very clear in dividing up the war powers, for example. So, Congress is complicit many times in terms of the power shifting to the presidency. But at the same time, if we're going to point fingers, who should we point fingers to in terms of kind of the dysfunction of American government? I would argue it's the voters. Your congressman gets elected, or congressperson gets elected at 90%. You know, it's not my member of Congress that's the problem. It's everybody else's member of Congress that's the problem. And so we like our own congressperson, and then, you know, they can bring home the bacon. They can do the casework, which is getting your problem solved with a big, faceless federal bureaucracy, and that gets them re-election. But at the end of the day, whose fault is that government may not be working as it was intended? I would argue that the American public bears a lot of responsibility here in terms of, again, focusing too much attention on the presidency, not paying attention in terms of down ballot races when they go vote.
Our conversation about presidential power, recorded last night in West Branch, continues after a short break. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This hour, a special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last night, I moderated a discussion on presidential power held before a live audience at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Panelists included Sarah McCammon, who covered the Trump campaign for NPR, presidential historian Tim Walsh, and political scientist Donna Hoffman of the University of Northern Iowa. Let's jump back into that conversation with a comment from a member of the audience.
All right, Reggie Ward, Cedar Rapids. And I would just really kind of make the premise that the power of the presidency is very divisive. Okay, so when you choose a candidate, it has a way of not allowing us to be able to see the other side. And in the U.S., we're really, really divided along party lines. And so it really, the president has the power to probably bring us together. But unfortunately, they end up having to cater to their base that elected them. So if I voted for Trump, he could really do nothing wrong. Very few voters for him will ever, regardless of what happens, because you're so tied to that vote that you don't want to ever be criticized for being wrong. So
Reggie's comment reminds me of what is typically done by a winning president, a unifying tone. At least in the inaugural address, when we talk about how this president was not conventional in that way. This is something that Donald Trump didn't think was necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in effect, the speech that he read on inaugural day was a speech crafted by Stephen Miller and Stephen Bannon, and it was somewhat divisive. And in general, if you look back on inaugural addresses, and certainly the ones that we generally consider successful in history, it tends to follow a theme of come together and follow me. We didn't see that, but I would like to challenge the audience to try to rise above the noise and to think, at least come up with one positive thing that you can think of every day about President Trump. Now, it's a challenge for many, but it shouldn't be for all. Some, because in effect, as a nation, we need to embrace the fact, if only to say I was gathered in a room and we were engaged in civic discussion. Certainly, President Trump has stimulated all of us to think about the importance of our institutions. Our Congress, as Donna suggested, as some of our speakers have suggested, think about what we expect of Congress. What do we expect of our presidents? How do we hold our presidents accountable? That's a good thing, and that has been stimulated in part by these first 100 days. So there are good things related to President Trump. We just have to find them, and I think it's important that we do. And I mean that in all seriousness.
Let's go to this side of the room. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name,
please,
is Arlie Clemens. My first vote was for Richard Nixon versus Jack Kennedy. That should tell you that I've been following politics for 60 years, and that, in fact, since I was about 15 years old. I'll be 80 in a couple weeks. I've watched this country get progressively weaker. The government gets bigger. The government gets poorer. The government gets more inefficient. The government gets more onerous. And lately, the government has gotten downright odious. The fact that bureaucrats can pass regulations and the politicians can't stop them, that's not a good situation. I ended up voting for Donald Trump. That wasn't my first choice. But it was the only choice I had, because if Hillary would have won, we would have had at least 8 more years of the odious situation that Mr. Obama brought, the corrupt cancer, he brought up on our culture. And I sincerely believe that. Mm-hmm. So,
what specifically?
Trump had to be our choice.
What's at the top of your list of what you hope President Trump will accomplish?
He already did. The Supreme Court.
Yeah. Okay, what else?
Oh, he could continue on. I don't know about this border thing, but you do have to stop illegal immigration. And if you're here illegally, you are illegal. And if you live in a sanctuary city and they're giving you protection, they are aiding and abetting a criminal.
Mm-hmm. Sarah McCammon, go ahead.
I was just wondering if I could ask you a question, because I covered, you know, a lot of Trump voters, and I'm no longer, you know, day-to-day engaged in political coverage. And so I'm curious, you know, one of the, I heard the sentiments that you're expressing from a lot of Trump voters. I think a frustration that with the sort of status quo, in a sense that Hillary Clinton would represent more of the same. I also heard a lot of feeling that President Obama had abused the office and had relied too heavily, had expanded presidential power, had relied too heavily on executive orders. I don't know if that was one of your concerns. But I'm curious, you know, President Trump sent out a press release today from the White House, you know, touting his 100 days of accomplishments. And near the top of that list was the number of executive orders he has signed. And I'm curious how you feel about, you know, going forward, this use of executive power. And do you want President Trump to use it with as much latitude as President Obama did?
I want Congress to become a Congress. I want those people to stay in Washington, D.C. 9 to 10 months out of the year. I want them to learn to play cards, play poker, play bridge, drink, dance, and converse with each other at least that amount of time. They find out that other guy isn't such a bad guy, and maybe I can work with that guy. I'm sick and tired of this Congress. It's so totally ineffective.
Okay, very good. Let's
thank
go.
You.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I'm Mark Peel from Waverly, and he kind of segued right into my concern is the use of executive orders and executive actions, and maybe a little bit of background of how has that progressed and grown through the years, because it concerns me greatly that I think that is an abuse of executive power, and not only with this president, but with his predecessor and many before him. So where did that really grow in its use and abuse, in my opinion? Because I think it's Congress has abdicated and the president has continued to pick up that role, and I think it's out of line with our Constitution.
I have the numbers right in front of me before anyone can respond. Going back to Ronald Reagan, 381 executive orders. President Clinton, 364. George W. Bush, 291. President Obama, the lowest of those modern presidencies. President's executive orders, 276. So the trend is something that you perceive, but it's actually going in the other direction.
Right, but is there a legislative, are there parameters or control over that, or how has, you know, the use of that through history, is that constitutional?
It is constitutional. Again, just counting executive orders may not be the most useful way to look at this, but as Congress has gotten more gridlocked, presidents have resorted more to executive orders to make policy. So you might remember George W. Bush ran on compassionate conservatism. One of the initiatives he had was the faith-based initiatives, which was a passel of things that he wanted to do, that he wanted Congress to do. Congress, largely of his own party, when this was going on, didn't really do much there. They did a few kind of small bore things, and George W. Bush did what he could to get that important initiative done through executive orders and establishing various rules within the federal bureaucracy in terms of how that was going to go forward. And that, you know, quite frankly, is legitimate in the sense that the bureaucracy, the federal bureaucracy, the president is the chief executive of it, and these executive orders, memorandums, proclamations, they're all essentially treated the same, are ways that you order those people within the federal bureaucracy who, if you don't like them, you call them bureaucrats. If you like them, you call them civil servants, who need sometimes direction because they are unelected. They do have a lot of discretion, and discretion is power. And the president can shape that, and the way that he does that is through proclamations, executive orders, et cetera. But it is the case that if you are president, you are judged on your legacy for your policy accomplishments. And in the past, that meant legislative accomplishments. But increasingly, presidents are turning to executive powers where they can to expand that a bit. And some people are critical of it, some people are not. But what you think of that power needs to be the same, whether it's a Republican in office or a Democrat in office. And you also need to understand that, yes, it's unilateral power in that the president can do it and it's done, but it's not unchecked power, unless we're talking about clemency, and that is unchecked. But that's kind of a different story. So if you, we saw with President Trump, the first executive order in terms of immigration got stopped by a court. You know, public opinion can play a role here at times as well in terms of limiting presidential power. But Congress in particular can also write laws to circumvent or stop executive orders. The unique thing or the great thing if you're president about executive orders is that you do them, they're immediate, they're done. The other two branches in terms of their checks typically take some time.
As we head into the home stretch of this special edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, Donna Hoffman there of the University of Northern Iowa, Tim Walsh, presidential historian with us, and NPR's Sarah McCammon with us. We're going to take a few more minutes also to get reflections from the audience. Let's go to this. I think we are on that side of the room. Let's go over here. Yes, sir. Your name?
John Taylor from Newton, Iowa. And I'm a retired journalist of sorts. And to me, the turning point and our governmental processes came when Herbert Hoover got voted out of office. He inherited a dramatic depression that's unprecedented in the history of our country and most of the world. So he lost to FDR, who established our current source of giveaway government and help all the people of the world, whether they needed, or all the people of the United States, whether they needed help or not. And I would like to see if anyone has any comments of this being a turning point in our way of government.
Without question. I mean, if you look for a precedent of a modern president. It certainly is in the, certainly in the 20th century, it's going to be FDR. And that great crisis of the economic collapse of this country was addressed by Franklin D. Roosevelt. And of course, he is the president who coined the concept of the 100 days and passing legislation and of direct assistance, direct aid and assistance to the American people. Because the presumption was, up until that time, that each American and each American community could help their own or help their own families. Well, with Social Security and with unemployment assistance and so forth and public works jobs, you have the federal government reaching out and assisting the American people directly. And quite frankly, the American people responded to it. So you could make the case, certainly, that having been elected four times, that FDR was able to put his finger on the pulse of what the American people wanted, and they expressed their views at the voting box, the ballot box. You know, there's an old joke that one comedian or journalist said that most American households have two pictures on their walls back in the 1930s. One was of Jesus Christ, and the other was of FDR, and they had a hard time deciding who was who. So in that sense, FDR is considered a great president, and along with Lincoln and Washington, they tend to be the three presidents, each one facing a different crisis. But depending on how you believe in direct aid and assistance from the federal government, what role you want from your federal government, you will embrace or disregard Franklin Delano Roosevelt, or as some people refer to him as Franklin Deficit Roosevelt.
And I would add that, you know, I teach a course called The Modern Presidency, and the modern presidency dates from 1933. So Roosevelt very definitely shapes what we talk about now. That's not to say, though, that people like Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, both of them before FDR, also did some significant things in terms of evolving presidential power that we continue to see even within the modern presidency.
One other facet that I want to quickly get in here, too, and I want to get to the other audience members I want to voice is the Trump presidency, his style, good for the office of the presidency? Is it good for American democracy?
Okay.
Your name, please?
My name is Lynn Smith. I'm from West Branch. I think there's a lot of toxicity in the campaign and the rhetoric and the hatred of all kinds of different people. And also, it's not good as we're looking at the presidency, not just as a one-issue thing, but it's got foreign policy, it's got economics, it's got all kinds of... It's a really big job. And to be unpredictable and I'll do it this way, no, I'll do it that way, and oh, China manipulates money, oh, no, they don't, oh, somebody does this, oh, no, they're not, NATO's irrelevant, oh, no, it's not. It's too wishy-washy, and that doesn't help us. It makes us look wishy-washy. It doesn't help our allies because they don't know what side we're on, and it doesn't help. It might confuse the opponents, which that might be good as subterfuge, but beyond that, I'm not thinking this is great.
Okay, I'm gonna jump down to our Trump voter here too. How do you react to that? Is this good for our democracy?
I disagree with that lady.
Why?
Well, look at what Obama did. He was drawing all the red lines in the sand, and then he would back off and turn his back. He didn't want to face the problems. He didn't have the guts to do it. Teddy Roosevelt said, carry a big stick. Help me, Tim. Teddy Roosevelt said,
speak softly
and carry a big stick. Obama certainly didn't do that.
So you're in tune with the President Trump's foreign policy so far, Syria, North Korea, he's doing the right way?
President Trump's got it all fouled up also. Maybe. So that means we've had 8 years of Obama and 1 year of Trump, or 100 days of Trump, and we're still all fouled up.
Okay, let's go to your name, please.
My name is Sylvia Quesada. I'm with University Heights, Iowa, not too far away from here. But I came here tonight thinking very much about the power of the presidents. And the first time around that I remember voting, it was, I think, I don't know, it was welfare reform was on the issue. That was the hot button that everyone was discussing. And I kid you not, my father, who is from Mexico, hardworking, decent, now naturalized citizen, dragged me out to vote because I was now eligible to vote. And he said, you have to go vote. And off we went to find. We went to a fire station, wrong place to vote. They helped me figure out the next precinct where I really belonged to vote. Ended up voting there. But the thing is that now that I'm 43 years old and I'm now in Iowa and I'm thinking, how does President Trump affect me here in the center of the heartland of America that is all red or pink if you take a look at the electoral votes after the 2016 election. And I keep thinking, I'm directly affected by immigration. That is an outstanding issue since Bush 2 or Bush 1 that hasn't been properly dealt with a comprehensive, well-thought-out, educated, calibrated plan that thinks about how we integrate people who are in our borders or come into our borders. And I am particularly affected by that at my age and as well-educated as I am now, because I still have first-generation cousins. These are cousins from my father's side and my mother's side who are undocumented. Unbelievable to think that these soccer moms are driving around in parts of this country, whether it be in California, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, or any other place, they are driving undocumented, and at any moment they can be ripped apart, picked up, and deported, or housed in deportation stations away from their families. Their husbands are either naturalized citizens or residents that have the green card here, but for whatever reason, the wives haven't made it. And my biggest concern is that this is un-American to be ripping apart families. And I've got to tell you that I was very upset with Obama in the second term because I thought for sure he might touch immigration early on, take care of it, and move on. But it became an issue that became a political football. It got taken care of at 11:59 p.m. before his presidency ended, and it turned out to be nothing more than fodder for this election, and it's a humanitarian crisis. It is not a political issue.
Let's swing back over here. Your name, please.
My name is Judy Allen, and I'm from Iowa City, and I just wanted to tie up a few things that have been bothering me for a long time about our president, our Congress, and our judicial system, our three branches of government, because, you know, we're asked to trust this person in charge of our country. There's a lot at stake for all of us here. We want him to succeed, but I have such a hard time looking at our current president because of the lack of transparency, no tax forms. True, he doesn't have to give them up, but wouldn't it be good to let us know what he was really invested in? The amount of blood, his own blood that he has that is profiting from the appointments that he's made of his own family members in his own cabinet, the what I would call kind of sad state of qualifications of so many cabinet members. Some are okay, but you have to question people's judgment when it is so blatant that all of this is about protecting something. Oh, not to mention then the Russia stuff that we keep getting bits and pieces and leaked out about that. There's something very troubling about having the president of our country be so secretive and unforthcoming with information. I think if he wants our trust and our belief and our vote again, he needs to show us that he is really for the people. And I don't believe that's happened so far.
My name is Johnny Stacks. I live just north of West Branch here. And I want to go on record and say that I'm a Trump supporter, not because I voted for him or because I agree with the things that he's doing, because I didn't and I don't most often, but because he's our president. And we need to be able to support the people that are in our office because our success is tied up with their success. And so if we can find a way to be able to get past this Trump, Hillary, Bernie, you know, and connecting to the celebrity of the presidency, we might actually start taking our responsibility back as the people that put these people in office. This is our responsibility. We have been abdicating these responsibilities to the presidency and giving these powers up to Congress, to the president, and we need to take that back by engaging in civil discourse to listen to each other and put aside our connection to the celebrities that we tie ourselves to from a political standpoint and actually listen to each other to find some common solutions about what affects us locally, what affects us as a state, and what affects us as a nation.
And that ends the discussion.
Edited for Time, recorded last night. the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. Many thanks to our panelists, Donna Hoffman, Sarah McCammon, and Tim Walsh. Also, of course, thanks to the Hoover Museum for being such a wonderful host for this A Nation Engaged conversation. Emily Woodbury produced and edited this hour. Our sound engineer was Jim Davies. Assistance from Lindsay Moon and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Find a podcast of this special edition of River to River online, as well as pictures from the event, at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.